Appellant ready to argue? Government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Brian Osterhage, and together with Major Jack Einhorn, we represent the petitioner, Major Nadal Hassan, in this matter. If I may, Your Honor, reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Army Court erred when it denied petitioner's recusal motion, and this court should issue the writ of mandamus ordering the removal of the Army Court appellate judges. Ultimately, there are two questions before this court today. First, can this court issue the writ? And second, should this court issue the writ? The answer to both of those questions is yes. Turning to the first question, can this court issue the writ? Under the All Writs Act, this court has the authority to issue all writs necessary and appropriate in aid of its jurisdiction. Now, importantly, under the Act, the authority of this court is not confined by issuing writs which are in aid of jurisdiction of appeals already pending, but also extends to cases in this court's appellate jurisdiction where an appeal is not yet perfected. And that is to say, if this court can hear this case at some stage on appeal, it may issue a writ now. And that is the principle announced in the Supreme Court in Roche and in Labai and in Dean Foods. Now, this case falls under this court's appellate jurisdiction because it may be appealed under Article 67 Alpha. And as a death penalty case, it is likely that this will be subject to mandatory review under Article 67 Alpha 1. Furthermore, the issue here, a biased judge, falls directly within this court's subject matter jurisdiction in Article 67, Charlie. As Hassan v. Gross states, a biased judge has the potential to directly affect the findings.
In Gross, we had evidence of bias. What do we got here?
Yes, Your Honor, you have the appearance of bias.
Okay, well, that's different.
Counselor, I mean, it seems to me at least that you're saying that there is an appearance of bias based on the way that the Army structures its rating system.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that we are taking any position with respect to how the Army is rating the court overall.
Isn't your complaint about the remaining person about the people, is that someone rates them who used to be the SJA?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor, it is, in the sense of this represents a almost classic conflict, as this court kind of stated, not this court, but the Navy Court stated in Hutchins, Your Honor, where military judges should recuse themselves on ruling on issues of their supervisors because the desire to spare a supervisor creates the apparent, if not actual, conflict of interest.
So they were permitted to recuse themselves, and all but three did recuse themselves, right?
Yes, Your Honor. For unknown reasons.
And recusal is a matter within the discretion, the initial discretion of the judge themselves, unless there is actual bias or an actual reason. So, for example, if one of them was the SJA.
Are you speaking with respect to statutory disqualification? Yes, Your Honor. However, the rule is with the appearance, if a reasonable person would question the judge's impartiality, knowing all the facts, then recusal is required, Your Honor.
But I guess, and I sort of alluded to this in the last case, you know, the Supreme Court in Will versus the United States way back in 1967 talked about this writ of mandamus in the criminal context, right? And it essentially said that unless somehow, I mean, I won't say what it essentially said, but, you know, you have a very high burden to meet as to why this is a question that should be addressed now as opposed to when and if, having conducted its Article 66 review, they affirm the findings and sentence of your client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you'd agree that we see implied bias cases all the time.
Yes, Your Honor. It is a high burden. I agree with that, Your Honor. However, I think it is appropriate here, given the appearance issue, number one, public harm. If we're talking about an inability to squarely address an issue on appeal if we wait for the 66 review, then we have to talk about the damage to the public confidence that cannot be repaired adequately on this appeal, and that's been recognized in federal circuits, citing to In Re Asbestos Litigation and Alexander v. Primerica Holdings, Your Honor.
Counsel,
you haven't yet identified any specific issue that would relate to Major General Risch's pretrial advice at the SJA, and so the government says that the issue isn't right. And I understand your position is yes, but one reason we haven't identified it yet is because we haven't been able to get the resources to investigate the matter. How are we supposed to respond to that? What if you never raise an issue with respect to the pretrial advice in this case or any other action that Major General Risch took when he was the staff judge advocate?
Well, Your Honor, I think I'd first respond to the fact that I disagree that there hasn't been any showing of wrongdoing, in the sense of, even if you look at it in the context of the Article 34 advice as a prosecutorial codal tool, which there's an open debate, I believe, in the law as to whether or not that remains a fact. But even if taking that, a trial counsel or prosecutor would be disqualified if he's the accuser, and the accuser is someone with another than an official interest in the case. So the question comes down to when then Colonel Risch was giving his advice, and not only his advice in the Article 34 with respect to that, but in advice in all matters with respect to this case. That includes expert requests, that includes advising on.
Aren't those issues a fact that you can develop via a motion, motions hearing at trial? That we can get all the facts and have a military judge weigh in and assess the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses, et cetera, et cetera, because we can't do that.
Yes, Your Honor. And to some extent, this was preserved at trial, Your Honor, with reference to a defective referral, although there are some new facts that have been submitted and are now part of the record for this court to review from the Army Court, Your Honor.
Counsel, could I ask you this? At the CCA, did you, I can't remember, but I seem to think that you brought a motion at the CCA, did you?
Yes, sir, we brought several motions at the CCA.
I mean, on this specific issue regarding the bias of the judges.
Yes, Your Honor, we asked them to recuse themselves.
Right. Did you ask for any other relief? Did you propose maybe having the deputy judge advocate general remove himself from the chain of these particular officers who are going to view this case?
Not that specific relief, Your Honor, mm-hmm. but we did ask for an alternative remedy in the sense of some sort of temporary abatement until such time that they were no longer rated by Major General Risch.
All right.
But doesn't that go to a problem here in terms of, as you've noted, first question we have to ask is, do we have the authority to issue the writ? And the second one is, should we? In terms of that second aspect of it, the question is whether there is any other adequate means to obtain relief. Would this issue be resolved in your mind if TJAG were to remove General Risch from serving as the rater of these three judges? And if that's the case, why are we getting involved in it at this stage? Because there is an other adequate means of addressing this. So why is this court getting involved?
Your Honor, so I'd have two responses for that, Your Honor. The first being, it is possible with respect to, I think there could be still an issue with respect to the three judges who have weighed in now twice on the recusal and have not only said no, but provided no analysis and provided no disavowal on the record to then, if they later became not rated, to say, well, we're okay. I think we would have some problems in asking for reconsiderations, because the question would be, even if you decided perhaps if we refiled the motions, is there going to be some sort of confirmation bias with respect to they've denied us twice now. Now that the barrier has been removed.
Isn't that an awfully slippery slope? You're essentially saying they're permanently tainted despite the fact that the particular act that you're citing as being the taint would be removed. Is that really a strong argument on your part?
I don't think, in all fairness, Your Honor, it's my best argument, Your Honor.
Okay. I'll let you move on to your better argument.
Nonetheless, Your Honor.
I appreciate the fact you concede.
And with respect to the second point in, isn't this an adequate means to relief, I think the question is, first, what means would I have? I'm not aware of any sort of regulatory or statutory right to request some sort of rating chain of these officers. Yeah, I would suggest just sending an email or a letter would not be, in hopes that they would change it, would not be an adequate alternative form of relief.
And that's a point well taken. But to what extent should we as a court, when we are talking about an extraordinary writ,
yes, Your Honor,
if we're looking at this and there's nothing on the record that would reflect whether anyone has bothered to go to TJAG and said, for example, hey, TJAG, you can simply pull Risch out of the rating chain here and this appellate problem goes away in a death penalty case. We don't know from the record whether that has happened, has not happened, but in terms of us deciding whether to exercise the authority, if in fact we have it, to issue an extraordinary writ, when we're looking at are there any other adequate means to address the problem, to what extent should we be looking at that type of extra legal means of addressing the problem that you're citing here?
Your Honor, I would say once we filed the recusal motion, especially given the time frame that it was in, it was incumbent upon the judges at that time to change or ask for a change of a rating scheme, Your Honor.
I think the other potential problem that you have, counsel, is that this notion that it has to be indisputably clear that you're entitled to the relief, right? So you can make an argument that there is apparent bias in this case, right? You make the argument, but it's not necessarily a winner. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, there's no directly on point authority that says that you win.
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense of, I agree with you that there is no authority, perhaps on point, that I can point to with similar facts, but I would disagree with you that it's not a winner. I mean, you have someone who is arguably disqualified, given the fact that he was there, given the fact that he feared for his family and this uncertain chaos.
It's been held that being there without more.
Yes, Your Honor.
Disqualified.
Yes, Your Honor, but there is, in fact, more. He had an officer who is personally responsible for at the attack site, dodging gunfire, who comes back to him that night, covered in blood, and then after the fact, or that day rather actually, his deputy immediately disqualifies himself because the petitioner has been communicating with the OSJA about war crimes and some other things that then Colonel Risch also knew about. I think it's just more than the fact that he was there, and I think also, Your Honor, to say that just being there, that kind of doesn't do justice to the immense trauma that was felt after the fact on Fort Hood and how big of an event that was.
Counsel, it would be one thing if the things that you just mentioned pertained to the judges that you want to have recused, right? I don't disagree with that. But you're asking us to go another step further, which is say it's not just them. It's because it's the person that experienced those things is their rater, right, which requires an additional kind of jump, which is therefore they're going to come out a certain way or therefore he's going to rate them a certain way because people are going to think that.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps...
Maybe I'm missing something.
Perhaps I don't follow you, and I apologize, Your Honor. I think the bottom line is, and I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. If I
may. Yeah, answer the question.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the bottom line is we have a credible, colorable allegation of an error that was committed by the court's own supervisor. I think any reasonable person would say, knowing those facts, I question their ability to impartially decide this case when I have to assess my own supervisor. And I would kind of reiterate the example in the pleadings, which is, would anyone doubt if General Risch was not the court's raider but my own? Would anyone think for a second that there would not be any sort of appearance problem of me zealously representing my client if General Risch were my raider and senior raider in this instance? I think that would be...
But judges don't have clients.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think...
And I'm just saying that's an important distinction.
I would agree that it's a distinction, Your Honor, but I still think that at the end of the day that presents the same sort of internal conflict with respect to how do I handle my supervisor who is responsible for me.
But, counsel, isn't it also true that General Risch cannot take into account in rating them, at least he might do it improperly, but he cannot properly take into account anything that they say in their opinions?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to, I think if you're getting at Article 37, Your Honor, with respect to not being able to retaliate, if you will, for things that they may have said in an opinion. And I would perhaps just point to Justice Scalia's concurrence in Weiss, which said that would never pass muster in a civilian system. And not only do we have just the normal rating scheme, as there was in Weiss, but we have an allegation of an error.
Chief Judge, I know counsel's time has run.
Go ahead.
I had two questions I wanted to ask very briefly. Now, Captain, are you saying that you are assuming that the government has taken no action with respect to this rating system issue, or that you just don't know?
Well, Your Honor, I
you're not in a position to know.
I will say that I received the last fiscal year's rating scheme, and I did receive this year's fiscal rating scheme from the government recently before it filed its initial response in this matter, and the DJAC continues to be the raider and senior raider, the court members, with the exception of
yeah, and then my second question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought you suggested or said that the remedy that Judge Olson suggested would not be a sufficient remedy at this point. Did I just misunderstand you?
That would be.
In other words, at this point, simply removing the Deputy Judge Advocate General from the chain for this panel, the officers on this panel, that would not be an adequate remedy?
Your Honor, I would foresee some issues with that, but obviously I would be on much looser ground in arguing that. But
right. Well, what would be the problem at that point? If your concern, as you say in your brief, is protecting the public confidence of the system, then once that were to happen, assuming it does, if it does, then wouldn't that, in fact, enhance the public confidence in the system? If, in fact, the Deputy Judge Advocate General was removed from the rating chain for the officers on this particular panel?
Yes, Your Honor, I can see your point. I think my counterpoint would be our concern from a practical standpoint that after they have twice put on the record that they will not recuse themselves and have weighed in now on motions directly affecting General Risch.
But they could never
That there could be a problem if we went back to them and tried to renew those motions now in time, with how much of a fair evaluation would we receive on those motions?
And you're saying that that's a perception that would lie, because you're not claiming that would be the actual, as a matter of fact, that that would happen. Or are you?
I'm not claiming as a matter of fact that would happen. I would say that is a perception issue, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Judge.
I appreciate the indulgence of the Chief Judge to follow up on that question. Does that perhaps, your position here, undermine the notion that we should issue an extraordinary writ? If the problem is going to be there whether we issue an extraordinary writ or not, why are we going to issue an extraordinary writ? Why shouldn't we let this wind its way through the regular direct appeal process if you're telling us, hey, there's no curing. This court cannot cure the problem. We cannot prevent a problem if we take the approach you just articulated. If that's the case, why are we going to issue an extraordinary writ? Why not just let it come through the direct appeal process?
Your Honor, what I would say is you can cure this with an extraordinary writ in the sense of if you did return it to TJAG for appropriate action consistent with the order that we are requesting, he could readily assign new judges who are not rated by...
Okay, but I thought you were just saying in response to Judge Sparks that there's already a problem based on the rulings that they've already engaged in.
Yes, Your Honor, with respect to those...
So that's what I mean in terms of we can't cure the problem,
yes,
in that aspect.
I would say that there could be a lingering perception problem with respect to the three judges who constitute Panel 2, not that there would be necessarily any problems of that nature with respect to other judges that he may call up to hear the petitioner's case.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Catherine Parnell, and along with my co-counsel, Captain Allison Rowley, I represent the United States. This court should deny petitioner's requested relief for two reasons. First, because this court should not exercise its jurisdiction over the petition for a writ of mandamus, and second, because this petition fails on its merits. This court has limited statutory jurisdiction under Article 67 UCMJ. That jurisdiction cannot be enhanced or expanded by the All Writs Act.
Well, let me stop you there for a minute. Are you suggesting that the concept of potential or anticipatory jurisdiction does not apply in the military courts?
Your Honor, I think that in light of this court's decision in United States versus Arness, and in the discussion of Loving, that this court has repudiated its supervisory jurisdiction over the military justice system.
That's different, though, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it is different, but still the discussion from this court's opinion in Loving versus United States indicates that its potential jurisdiction has limits. And while I think there is an argument that under 67 alpha, this court could grant the petition for good cause, I do not think that it should do so in light of its potential jurisdiction. So with respect to the merits of this
before petition, we get to the merits, is there any reason that our courts acting in aid of jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction, would be different from the circuit courts? In the appellant's brief cites circuit court decisions from all the different circuits, and one that's very similar is the D.C. Circuit's decision, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's case, in which appellate court, before the appeal was concluded, ordered mandamus to remove a judge. Is there any reason that our court's jurisdiction would be different from the courts of appeal?
appeals?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but I would point this court to its precedent in Arnaz. While this court has certainly issued a writ of mandamus to correct similar errors before, as in Walker, it has also discussed the potential for recusal of appellate military judges in its Article 67 capacity, as in Mitchell and Lane and Lynn. And the difference in Khalid in that particular case is that those facts are significantly more extreme. So if you look to the merits of that particular petition, we're talking about a judge who was appointed to the CMCR who had already indicated prior to his appointment that he had believed that the defendant in that case was guilty. And so when we look at the facts of that case as compared to the merits of this one, I think we're in a very different position.
That goes to whether it was proper to issue the writ, not whether there was jurisdiction to issue the writ.
Acknowledged, Your Honor. However, pointing to the potential difference between this court's jurisdiction under the All Writs Act and that exercised by the federal circuits, I simply point to the fact that this court has done it before, but Arnaz and Clinton would suggest that this court could take a different approach in this case, specifically because to the extent that petitioner is asking for this court to interfere with the rating scheme of the Judge Advocate General for the United States Army, under Clinton that appears to be non-justiciable. And when we look at whether this case is ripe for review with respect to its merits, we're talking about an issue that this court regularly reviews under Article 67, as in Mitchell. And given the presumptions...
Counsel, you say the issue isn't justiciable. I think it's true that under Clinton we couldn't order a change in the rating scheme, but I don't think that that's what counsel has asked for. I think counsel has asked for just recusal of the judges. The rating scheme could remain the same. Those judges could continue to be rated. They just can't sit on this case.
Acknowledged, Your Honor, but with respect to the argument that was made earlier about whether this court can actually cure the extant error that appellant alleges with a writ of mandamus in this case, it would suggest that there is still an error he believes he cannot correct with that petition for a writ of mandamus, even if those judges were to be disqualified. And furthermore, with respect to the merits, given the presumption that this court articulated in Mitchell and in Norfleet about the independence of military judges, the inability to rate a military judge based on their decisions on the merits, the presumptions are in favor of leaving the Army Court of Criminal Appeals in place. And the judges that have recused themselves have done exactly what we would expect them to do. They're presumed to execute their duties faithfully and in accordance with the law. And so
that may be the case, but I think your colleague is arguing that there's a huge perception problem here, kind of an implied bias, so to speak. Isn't that an important concern? Wouldn't the Army be rightfully concerned about such a perception?
Yes, Your Honor, that perception is important. But in Norfleet, this court said that the preparation of fitness reports for appellate military judges by senior judge advocates does not create a circumstance in which the impartiality of a judge might reasonably be questioned. And the test, when we look at that objective person, we have a number of facts that are at our disposal. For instance, the judges who believe themselves to have a conflict have already affirmatively recused themselves. Appellant has not submitted any particular assignments of error. No one on the Army Court is improperly, or the court is not improperly constituted as it was in Walker. Everyone is properly certified and appointed by the judge.
I understand General. All that, but I mean, why would the Army want to have this perception lie, given the nature of this case and its profile? Has anyone asked the Deputy Judge Advocate General whether or not he could step aside in the reviewing chain in this case?
Your Honor, I'm not in a position to comment on the opinion of either the DJAG or the TJAG with respect to this case. But what I can...
Or what they've been told.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Or what they've been told or asked to do.
Your Honor, I'm not in a position to speak.
You're only a lowly captain, is that what you're trying to say?
As gracefully as possible, Your Honor.
You said that the assignments of error have not been identified. Would you agree or disagree with this statement that once those assignments of error have been identified and litigated, or at least something has been done, we'll be in a better position to know what, if any, actual basis there is to say that there's implied bias?
Yes, Your Honor, for two reasons. And the first is, as Your Honor mentioned, we're in the middle of the Article 66 review, and so we have a situation of Schrodinger's court. We really don't know how the Army Court is going to decide any potential assignments of error.
Well, do we even know what the assignments of error are?
We do not, Your Honor. We don't know what those assignments of error are, and we don't know what the Army Court will do with them. The appellant is presuming an error in a review that has not happened yet. And furthermore,
Counsel, on that particular point, I believe the appellant's position was that they haven't identified exactly what the error is because they've been denied resources to continue their investigation in that they would need in order to make the assignment of error, that they've requested discovery and preservation of documents and other items, and those requests have been denied. Seems a little odd to say, well, the case is not ripe at this point.
Yes, Your Honor, your point is well taken. However, just because the Army Court of Criminal Appeals has decided issues on their merits against appellant or petitioner does not necessarily mean that they are biased against him. When we look at this court's opinion in Martinez, and
so I'm not suggesting that they're biased against them because they decided against it. I'm just saying that I believe their position is that this case is ripe because they want to investigate and present an issue concerning the General Risch's conduct, but they haven't been able to do so.
Yes, Your Honor, and based on those motions, if I recall the Army Court's opinions and decisions in that, it's that they don't believe that appellant has met the threshold for appellate discovery. And so when we look at this court's opinion in Martinez and what it means to say that a judge is biased or that the court is biased, we have to look at whether there is an opinion on the merits of a motion or an issue that is based on something other than what the judge knows in their official capacity or the application of the law.
So here's a question, counsel, which is I think one of my colleagues has noted, this is a death penalty case and one that has obviously gotten some press attention. And so query, why would the government, if appellate discovery is being sought that can resolve some of these issues, why wouldn't the government say to the CCA, Your Honors, you know, we agree?
Your Honor, with respect to some of those motions, the government certainly has that we agree with discovery, we agree with the hearing, and just not in all of them, certainly. And those are where the petitioner has not met his burden for showing that appellate discovery or additional appellate resources, in addition to what he was given at trial, are necessary to complete the review. And while this court noted in Loving versus United States that death is different and that we look carefully at these cases, due process as is due process. And so going through the Article 66 review and the potential review of this court under Article 67 is the appropriate way to look at this, particularly where this court, in order to find that petitioner is entitled to the writ of mandamus, he has to meet those three Cheney criteria: the clear and indisputable right of relief, the necessary and appropriate nature of the writ, and that there are no other adequate means. With respect to clear and indisputable, even based on Mitchell and Norfleet, while there may be an appearance or discussion to be had, the appellant at this point has not satisfied the factual predicate to overturn the Mitchell presumption. So there's no clear and indisputable right to relief. With respect to the necessary and appropriate nature of issuing the writ, it's a drastic remedy for drastic circumstances, as in Khalid, where we had a judge who had prejudged the guilt or innocence of the appellant in that case. That's not what we have here. And where this court has a mechanism to review this under Article 67, it may not grant extraordinary relief under the All Writs Act, because there is another adequate means. This court clearly, competently, and capably addresses issues of judicial disqualification in its Article 67 capacity.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Is the government concerned about some unwanted precedent being set here? Is that the concern? I'm trying to understand why there would be resistance to this issue that seems to be one that can be remedied either, albeit administratively, but I mean, why is there a concern that some unprecedented decision is going to come out of this court, or there's some sort of precedent that's going to be set that will be unfavorable to the government in other cases?
Your Honor, I think I have two responses to that. And the first is based on Mitchell and Norfleet. There is a presumption that these military appellate judges, regardless of their rating chain, are
I understand that. Let's go to your second one. Then.
Right, and then the second point is with respect to the structure of the military justice system. Our senior judge advocates are always going to come with baggage, if you'll permit the term. They're always going to come with prior assignments. That's also true for our magistrates. It's true for our special victim counsel. It's true for everyone who operates in the military.
But this kind of baggage? I mean, isn't the SJA at the command where the case was tried? Isn't that kind of – that's a – couple of travel cases in a footlocker, isn't it? So to speak.
Perhaps even a steam trunk, Your Honor.
Maybe.
That being said, I think that the mere fact that our DJAG happened to be the staff judge advocate at the time that this case arose is insufficient to overturn the Mitchell presumptions with respect to his subordinates, especially because he is and was recused from this case, and because Article 37 prevents him from rating these judges with respect to their findings on the merits in the conduct of their judicial duties. So in light of those presumptions, I think that the government is interested in maintaining the precedent in Mitchell and Norfleet, which we believe to be well-reasoned, but also absent an extraordinary circumstance or an emergency, the facts like we have in Khalid or like in Walker where the panel was improperly constituted because they hadn't been appointed by the TJAC, then the government is interested in maintaining the presumption of independence and the structure of the military justice system. And to the extent that this could be remedied by changing the rating chain, that is well within the discretion of the TJAG. And for purposes of issuing an extraordinary writ, appellant simply hasn't met his merit burden for showing that this is the only means.
Has appellant asked, as far as you know, have they asked that the rating chain be changed?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, there's been no specific request for the rating chain to be changed, only the recusal and disqualification of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals.
So I guess the theme here is this court, as we see the right, we'll stay in our lane. We're just focused on issue avoidance in a death penalty case. That's all.
Certainly, Your Honor, and that point is well taken. But under Mitchell and Norfleet, I believe that the position of the government is that those factual predicates have not been met to show that there is actual or an appearance of bias.
There's also the limits on this court's ability to seek issues outside of its lane under a writ of mandamus.
Understood, Your Honor. Pending any further questions from this court should deny the request of relief.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Your Honor, I would just like to underscore the fact that we don't have to come here and prevail on the issue of whether or not then-Colonel Risch should have been disqualified. All we need to show at this stage is that there is a colorable claim of disqualification, colorable claim of an error to say now we have to go back to the court and say, we have this error, we need resources, we're going to brief this issue or whatever for this conflict to happen.
Also, you're saying that it's a colorable claim, and point to a Supreme Court or Federal Circuit Court thing that says it's a colorable claim as opposed to a clear and indisputable right to relief.
A colorable claim.
They're very different standards.
In the sense of the SJA disqualification, Your Honor? That's what I'm speaking to, the SJA disqualification. I think if we go back to Hutchins, and Hutchins says, right, and I think rightly so, a military judge should not partake in rulings on the credible allegations of errors of his supervisor. He should disqualify himself. Therefore, we go back. Do we have any sort of credible allegation at this point as to his disqualification? It would serve as a basis to say you should disqualify, and not just should, you must. Because this is your own supervisor in a death penalty case. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, public confidence is of the utmost importance in the military justice system. I would just like to also comment, going on, I think, further kind of talking about whether or not we've met our burden to the clear and indisputable right, which is really here, did the Army Court clearly abuse its discretion in not accusing itself, which is you have not only this issue of error and whether or not they're going to rule on matters involving their own supervisor, and in many instances only supervisor, but you also have the fact that this is a high-profile case, and the government counsel has quoted Norfleet extensively, and allow me to please quote it here. There may be cases in which the ruling by a military judge on an issue would have such a significant and lasting adverse direct impact on the professional reputation of the superior for competence and integrity that recusal should be considered. So that is an additional layer here, this high-profile nature of the case, the reputations that are at stake. excuse me. And there's one more layer to this problem, more so than just them weighing in on an error, more so than just the fact that it is a high-profile case with reputation at stake. And again, I'm quoting Norfleet. We have emphasized that where the military judge makes full disclosure on the record and affirmatively disclaims any impact on him, where the defense has a full opportunity to voir dire the military judge, to present evidence on the question, and where such record demonstrates that appellant obviously was not prejudiced by the military judge, the concerns of 902A are fully met. We do not have here, not only do we not have a ruling, but we have no affirmative disclosure on the record of how this is not going to impact them. We are not able to voir dire the military judges.
Have you asked to?
We have not, Your Honor, but according to this court's opinion in United States v. Hamilton, Your Honor, voir dire does not, is not an option at the appellate level. So we haven't really had a full opportunity to engage. So I think that is an added and important factor to consider when we consider the question of should these judges have recused themselves from this case. And one last comment. The government counsel also noted Arnes quite a few times in this repudiation. I think Arnes really stands for one proposition, which is if your conditions that would have triggered jurisdiction no longer exist or extinguish, there is no jurisdiction. I think that is inapplicable to this case. There are still potential avenues for jurisdiction. There is still potential jurisdiction in this case for this court to have the authority to issue the writ of mandamus here. And again, I'm pointing back to Dean Foods, Roche, and Levine. Pending any further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess, pending further order of the court.